and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
What has happened in Washington that affects the lives of people living in Illinois?
Illinois' senior senator Dick Durbin is here tonight to discuss the country's redistricting battle, the 2026 midterms, his retirement, and much more. New data shows shootings and homicides are down in areas where the gunshot detection system ShotSpotter was removed. And Illinois is getting some new neighbors as armadillos are moving north. We begin tonight with a wide-ranging one-on-one with U.S. Senator Dick Durbin right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The FBI has agreed to cooperate with Texas law enforcement to locate the more than 50 lawmakers who fled the state for Illinois and New York. The Democratic lawmakers left Austin to block an effort to redraw state congressional maps that would create five more Republican-leaning districts per President Donald Trump's request. The turmoil comes as the country looks ahead to midterm elections and Illinois braces for change as Senator Dick Durbin steps aside after five terms in the U.S. Senate. Joining us now is U.S. Senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin. Senator, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good to be here.
So, Texas Democrats, we know that they have been in Illinois all week attempting to thwart, as we mentioned, this vote on a redistricting measure in their home state. You were planning to appear with them at a news conference yesterday, but it was canceled following an alleged bomb threat, which, of course, evacuated their hotel in St. Charles yesterday. Is this the right move by Texas Democrats to leave the state?
Well, I can tell you they have few alternatives. They are a minority in the legislative setting there, and so they have to appeal based on the rules, and the rules on making a quorum require their presence. So they're using one of the few tools they have.
FBI Director Kash Patel has granted your Senate colleague John Cornyn's request to help locate the lawmakers. Governor Pritzker says that the FBI has no jurisdiction over this matter in Illinois. What if the FBI does attempt to come to Illinois, or New York for that matter, and take lawmakers back to Texas?
First, it comes as no surprise that Kash Patel, as head of the FBI, is involved in this political venture. He came through my Senate Judiciary Committee. I voted against him. He's not equipped for the job, and he's shown himself to be way too political. The senator, John Cornyn of Texas, whom he's trying to help, is in a red-hot primary and 15 points behind. And so he is trying to find a way to get the headlines away from Ken Paxton, the attorney general of Texas, by being tougher than Paxton. So he's proposed something which, as Governor Pritzker said, just doesn't work. When it comes to state law enforcement, we have a state, and we haven't called on the FBI. They'll do their duty as required by law. And so this notion of bringing in the FBI, bringing in the feds, think about it, a national police force, is that what Donald Trump's promising us?
Today, Vice President J.D. Vance was in Indiana to discuss getting that state to redraw its own congressional maps. There are reports that the White House is also eyeing Ohio for this same attempt to pick up more Republican seats in the House. I mean, is this a slippery slope if Democrats respond by redrawing their maps to increase the number of Democratic seats?
Not looking to do that, and I agree with Governor Pritzker, that is not our intent, but we're going to be mindful of all the options. What's at the bottom of this? What is the base of this? The base of it is that Donald Trump realizes what he's done so far, his legislative agenda, is wildly unpopular, and he's facing an election contest in just a few months as candidates are being chosen and filing for office. He's trying to buy an insurance policy, go to the friendliest states he can find, and up the number in the Republican majority so it's easier for him to hang on to Congress. I don't think it's going to work. But I'll tell you, I understand the sentiment that Governor Pritzker expresses. We're not going to sit here and be taken for patsies. This notion that we're going to follow the law and follow the traditions when President Trump is throwing him out the window is unacceptable.
What makes you feel confident that it won't work?
That
President Trump's attempt to redraw maps in red states to pick up more seats in the House, that this effort won't work?
I'm not sure it will. I don't know one way or the other how the courts will rule, and they'll be ruling initially on a state-by-state basis with some pretty friendly courts.
14 of the 17 House members from Illinois are Democrats. That means Republicans make up just under 18% of the Illinois delegation. Trump won nearly 44% of the vote in Illinois. Are Democrats in Illinois just as guilty of redrawing the maps to their benefit as they are accusing Texans of being?
Well, wherever you draw it, certainly in Illinois, you have to meet certain standards. If you're discriminating against groups, denying them their vote or their vote counting, that can stop a map, and it has in many, many states. We've passed that test, and it's an indication of a good faith effort on our part. But let me be candid with you. It is a partisan process in our state. And all but other, when you look at the other states, there are about eight of them where it isn't. So the question is, what are we going to do, wave the white flag and say, we're going to go to an independent commission, but all the red states can continue to choose political maps? I wouldn't support that.
So you feel like it needs to happen in both red and blue states, if that's what's going to happen?
I would certainly support it on a national basis, but declaring surrender at this point would give us a disadvantage.
Several weeks ago, the Senate confirmed Emil Bove's appointment to the Federal Appeals Court. He is a former defense attorney for President Trump. He has limited to no experience with federal courts. He has been supportive of the January 6th rioters who have been pardoned by the president. Yet your Senate colleagues confirmed him. Only two members of the Republican Party voted with Democrats to vote against him. Can true bipartisanship exist when approving judicial appointees and nominees?
It is so rare now. It used to be that in the most egregious cases, you could hope to summon a bipartisan majority against a nominee or for a nominee. That's not the case so much anymore. And part of it is the loyalty of the Republican senators to the MAGA leadership in the Republican Party. Part of it is their own personal fear that they're going to be defeated in a primary election if they vote against President Trump. You put that all together, and we don't have very many victories to show this year when it comes to nominations.
Today, turning to the Middle East, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that he intends to seize full control of Gaza. You and over half of the Senate Democrats, you voted in favor of stopping the U.S. from continuing to send weapons to Israel. What is your reaction to what the Prime Minister said today?
I believe in Israel. I believe it has a right to exist and defend itself, and that's been my position throughout my career. But what we're seeing in Gaza is horrific and unacceptable, and violates the rules of war as far as I'm concerned. Using starvation as a weapon of war is against the rule of law, and I think we should be very vocal in opposing Netanyahu's efforts. This notion that he's going to control Gaza, at what cost and what credibility? The bottom line is the people in this situation, the Palestinians, should have their own secure, safe homeland as long as it's no threat to Israel.
Do you believe a genocide is happening here in Gaza?
I wouldn't use that word. I'm not going to go into categorization of that kind. But I will tell you, it is horrific, unacceptable, and the United States should make that clear.
Is there a compromise to be reached here? And
of
what
course,
would it be?
I think there is, but this battle has been going on for decades and won't be easily resolved. But the notion of a ceasefire and the release of hostages is the important first step. Get that done and then see what it takes to move to the next step. And I believe other Arab states will step in at that point and join in the effort.
Of course, we've talked a lot in recent months about the president's passage of the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, which does a number of things, of course, because it is massive. But how do you think this bill will play with voters in the 2026 election?
Well, I'm seeing how it's playing out this month as I come back home with our August recess and check on what are the major issues. The major issue is health care. And the belief that the president's big, beautiful budget was a disaster when it came to health care. To think that 15 million Americans are going to lose their health insurance, to think that the cost of medical care and health insurance is going to go up for so many others, that we're going to lose hospitals, that we're going to lose clinics in the process, that nursing homes are going to be unable to stay open. This is going to be a disaster. And what is it for? It's for generating enough money to continue the Trump tax cuts for the wealthiest people in this country. That is just unacceptable. I have had more hospital administrators in the last several weeks from all over the state, including the city of Chicago, in contact with us in desperation because of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill.
It is passed. It is law. The president has signed it, of course. Is there anything that can be done legislatively or even on a state-by-state level to mitigate the impact?
the state-by-state level becomes impractical. The burden, according to Trump, should fall on the governors. And this governor is struggling to make ends meet, dealing with pension crises and other things. I think it's unlikely to believe that the governors can bail out Trump from this perfidy. The bottom line is this. We are going to lose good hospitals around the state and in the city of Chicago and our surrounding areas. And people are going to be denied health care. And as a consequence, we're going to find ourselves with a lot of sick people.
Along with federal cuts to Medicaid and SNAP, of course, the administration has also moved forward, as it did last month, with cutting $1.1 billion from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which announced its plans to close down last week, of course, as a result. You've said that Trump is declaring an attack on public media. What impact do you think that'll have on public media and on democracy?
Well, I think it'll have a negative impact. And the bottom line is this. We need more independent voices speaking to the American people. We look at the surveys, and very few people are coming to the televisions and radios as they once did for their news. They have other sources that may be reliable, may not. I think Corporation for Public Broadcasting has proven itself reliable over the years. I don't believe it's partisan. Perhaps the other side does. But to say that we're going to quiet this voice and give fewer options for information to the American people is just plain wrong. It tells you that this president is not prepared to take the kind of criticism that ordinarily comes with the office. He'd rather shut down the opposition.
Shifting a little bit to environmental issues, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, it's up for reauthorization. You've been a champion, of course, of the Great Lakes. The legislation, though, hasn't passed through the House yet. What happens if these funds should dry up?
Well, I'm afraid a lot of projects that are being pursued in order to keep the Great Lakes an environmental safe area will be at risk, definitely at risk. This program started under President Obama, and we have used it wisely, I think. This is an extraordinary asset. They asked the people of Chicago many years ago, what is the one thing that distinguishes this city from all others? And they said Lake Michigan. They understand it. I think we do, too, intuitively. This is God's resource he's given us to watch, and this program is designed to do just that. This idea that we're going to stop environmental sensitivity is just plain wrong.
Do you think the system of checks and balances is still at work in the country's government?
It is, but narrowly. When you look at the Constitution and say, in the extreme, what is the area to hold back the President of the United States? And in the extreme, it's a situation where it's a court order from the Supreme Court that says, Mr. President, this is what you must do, or this is something you can't do. And then the question, he defies it. Says, I'm not going to follow it. And he's been tempting us with that kind of conduct leading up to this point. But that is what's at stake here. And we've never tested that in our history.
What happens?
We don't know the answer.
We do.
How would you enforce a Supreme Court order that a president of the United States said, I'm not going to follow? We've never quite faced that.
Okay.
Hope we don't.
Eyes open. So you announced your retirement earlier this year. What led you to that decision after nearly 30 years?
Well, I've served longer as an elected U.S. Senator in Illinois than anyone in history. I'm honored to have had that opportunity. And secondly, I'm a realist. No matter what your area of specialty is in Congress, particularly in the Senate, after a period of time, one of your majors becomes geriatrics. You notice that age takes its toll on many people. I want to walk out the front door of this job rather than being carried out the back door. And I think this is the time to do it.
Long-serving representatives Jan Schakowsky, Danny Davis, they have also recently announced their plans to retire. Do you think it's time for a newer, younger generation? And what do you say to them?
The voters make that decision. When people say to me, well, you're 80 years old, you ought to get the hell out of there, Durbin. I say, do you know how old Bernie Sanders is, the man who's drawing largest crowds in history for his rallies? He's 83. And I keep saying to him when I see him on the Senate floor, you better not stumble and fall, buddy, because I keep using you as an example of someone older than me who's still making a great contribution. So let the voters decide. Let them take a look at each candidate and decide if it's time.
A lot of conversation about whether or not the Democratic Party has lost its way, whether or not the voters still have confidence in the party. What do you think the party should be telling voters right now?
Well, I think we've got to define ourselves more clearly. And I take that criticism as constructive. It's saying to us, step up and tell us what you believe in. Tell us what you're going to fight for, and we'll decide if it's consistent with our family's values. That's a reasonable question in any campaign. And in this situation, we have a president with his own agenda, which is not popular. So I think we're in a position to move forward as a party, to define our goals clearly, and to identify with the voters for a majority.
What should those goals be? What should the priorities be?
Start with the pocketbook of voters. This notion that we're going to raise the cost of health care across the board and the cost of health insurance is inconsistent with what people feel about their economic circumstances. Secondly, I learned as I moved around the state and around the city, I hear over and over again about housing, how important it is to have affordable housing and how difficult that is. That's something that an issue that we see over and over again. And finally, as I mentioned in healthcare, this is an issue that affects every single one of us.
You've said that there's still more that you want to accomplish as a legislator. You've got 17 months left. Would you say that those priorities match what you would like to focus on in these 17 months, or are there others?
Well, I would say those are important priorities for me personally. It's the hundreds of thousands of young people who've been protected by DACA and the DREAM Act, who've been given a chance to stay in the United States, get educated, and to contribute to our economy. They've done a remarkable job. They deserve an opportunity to be citizens. They were brought to the United States as little kids, didn't make the decision. Give them a chance to prove themselves. And I worry that in 17 months I won't be able to get that done, but I hope I can.
You have not endorsed any of the three Democratic candidates who have announced plans to run for your seat. Your colleague Tammy Duckworth, has already endorsed Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. What are you looking for in a successor, and do you still intend not to endorse?
I don't plan on endorsing. We have three good candidates. Maybe others will surface in the days ahead. But the bottom line is any one of the three can do this job. If something pops up in the campaign that I think is noteworthy, I might reconsider this. But for the time being, I'm going to stand on the sidelines for this race.
As a voter, as someone who has held this seat for quite some time, what are you looking for? What does it take to be the senator of Illinois?
I want somebody who recognizes they're not representing just Chicago, as great as this city may be. It's a big state, 102 counties. Engage. Get into southern Illinois and take a look around. It's a little different than the city of Chicago, but they're great people. Some of them vote our way, some don't. But make sure that you're a statewide candidate.
Okay. U.S. Senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin, congrats on making this decision to retire. Best of luck. We hope to have you back very soon. Thank you.
I do, too. Thank you.
And we're back with more right after this. Mayor Brandon Johnson pulled the plug on ShotSpotter nearly a year ago. Critics warned the decision to turn off the controversial gunshot detection system would unleash a wave of gun violence on the city's south and west sides. Well, a new analysis suggests those fears were unfounded. City data shows violent crime and homicides dropped significantly in the 12 neighborhoods once home to ShotSpotter sensors. Heather Sharone joins us now with more. Heather, so break this down for us.
So areas that had ShotSpotter sensors saw a 17.8% decrease in violent crime and a 37.5% decrease in the number of homicides. Now, there's no evidence in this analysis by Rob Vargas of the U of Chicago Justice Project. He's a sociology professor, that the removal of ShotSpotter caused this decrease in crime, which is somewhat in line with the citywide drop in crime we've seen in the first 6 months of 2025. But it certainly suggests that the removal of ShotSpotter did not cause a public safety threat, as so many older people and South and West Side residents warned the mayor.
The Chicago City Council, they twice rebuked Johnson and demanded that he reverse his decision to scrap that system. Does this analysis show that the mayor made the right call?
Well, Vargas told me that it certainly suggests that Johnson did the right thing by sticking to his guns under intense pressure. However, the causes of crime increases and the decreases are hard to pinpoint with any specificity. So, like I said, the only thing we can do is say the removal of ShotSpotter didn't make anything worse in neighborhoods that have really suffered under persistent violent crime for decades.
So under pressure, Johnson agreed to consider proposals for a new gunshot detection system. Does the mayor still think the city needs one?
Well, he dodged this question at a press conference earlier this week, sort of saying he was in favor of anything that works to reduce crime and increase public safety. However, the city has taken no action to move forward on any of the 8 proposals that it got all the way back in April, suggesting this is certainly at least not a priority for the Johnson administration. And with this data in hand, it's hard to see why Johnson would spend millions of dollars to set up a new gunshot detection system. And he's said that it has to cover the entire city, something that really doesn't exist.
And to be clear, of those proposals, did not Sound Thinking, the owner of ShotSpotter, also submit one?
Certainly, and I reached out to them for comments about this decrease in crime, and they said they couldn't comment because of the ongoing contract process.
Of course. Okay, so the analysis, it also looked at whether violence interruption programs are helping to reduce crime and homicides. What did it find?
Well, it looked at specifically one program that has state and local funding, the Peacekeeper program, which trains residents to sort of diffuse disputes to prevent them from spiraling into violence. And in areas of the city that had that active program, the decrease in crime was more than 20%, significantly more, perhaps, than the citywide decrease. Now, the big issue here, as we've talked about on this show, is that the funding for these programs are incredibly uncertain at this point, and it's not clear whether they can be sustained given the cuts in federal funding and the city's own massive budget crisis.
Yes, another subject that Heather is spending lots of time paying
lots
attention
time.
To. Lots of time, whether you want to or not. Heather Giron, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. Up next, Patty Whetley introduces us to the state's new neighbors. That's right after this. What do you picture when you think of Illinois wildlife? Probably deer, raccoons, skunks come to mind. Surprise, you can add armadillo to that list. The shelled mammals have been working their way north from Texas for more than a century, and they have already been spotted in southern Illinois, and they reportedly have their sights set on the bright lights, big city of Chicago. Our Patty Whetley is joining us now to give us those details. Patty, so we tend to associate armadillos with places like Mexico, Texas.
Yes.
What are they doing in Illinois?
You know, ever since they arrived in Texas in roughly the 1850s, or what's now Texas, they have just continued to consistently, if slowly, move their way north. And a lot of that has to do with climate change. You know, this is an animal that doesn't hibernate, doesn't like the cold, digs for its food in the ground, but there's less and less snow cover, and the winters are getting warmer. So it's just kind of creeping up along with warmer winters.
Short legs, but they move quickly.
Yes.
Because there's some evidence that they may have migrated as close as Kankakee. What do we know about that?
Yeah, a scientist at the Field Museum a couple years ago took a sample of water, analyzed the environmental DNA within that water from the Kankakee River, and lo and behold, she was surprised to find armadillo DNA sequence turned up. Just a smidge under what she would consider 100% confidence, but there was evidence of the armadillo there. So, you know, they're here.
They're here. More research to be done on that,
yes.
I'm sure. Another scientist that you spoke with at the Field Museum said
yes.
armadillos could appear in Chicago within the next 5 to 10 years.
Yes.
How might their presence disrupt the local ecosystem?
Yeah, scientists are saying, you know, it's not a matter of if they show up, it's when. And the short answer is we don't know how they're going to affect the local ecosystem. That's why they're kind of trying to get a baseline now. And they're asking people in central and northern Illinois to report their sightings. So we want to know what's the status of certain species of birds now, and then what happens when armadillos come along and maybe start disrupting the nests that they have on the ground? What if they start competing with raccoons for resources? They don't really have predators here that we know of, at least as long as jaguars stay south. So, you know, we don't really know. They're not supposed to be here. We don't know what their impact will be.
Okay, so it sounds like we should probably get used to seeing them once that
yes.
time comes. What should
yes.
we know about them?
Well, they're about the size of a cat. So if you see a giant armadillo online, which is about the size of me, that's not the ones that we're expecting here. The only species in North America is the 9-banded armadillo,
that
which
we're
means
looking
it
at right
has
now.
These like yep. 9 flexible bands, kind of like a bendy straw that allows it to bend, does not roll up into a complete ball. Only the 3-banded do that. And mamas out there will be interested to know that they have 4 identical quadruplets every time.
Every time they reproduce,
it's identical quadruplets.
Little armadillo babies.
Yes.
Okay, Patty Whitley, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Patty's full story all about the armadillo babies, the ones that roll up into a ball, on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. And that's our show for this Thursday night. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for the Week in Review. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a personal injury law firm working to preserve the dignity and rights of all individuals.